From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And then I learned that Senator Ashcroft was opposing me. I was very surprised to hear that he had gone to the Senate floor and called me pro-criminal, with a tremendous bent toward criminal activity, that he told his colleagues that I was against prosecutors and the culture in terms of maintaining order.
African-American Judge Ronnie White testifies against John Ashcroft as Attorney General. Thousands are ready to march on Washington to protest the Bush inauguration. And on Clinton's last full day in office, we'll take a look at NAFTA, one of the cornerstones of the Clinton presidency. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Confirmation hearings for Attorney General nominee John Ashcroft wind up today, and he appears headed for confirmation. While Senator Edward Kennedy had raised the possibility of trying to filibuster the nomination, the Senate Democratic leadership has indicated it won't mount an organized fight against the nomination. The key witness against Ashcroft testified yesterday. Missouri Supreme Court Judge Ronnie White said Ashcroft seriously distorted his record when he blocked White's promotion to a federal judgeship. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. Some cabinet nominations are moving faster than others. Secretary of State designate Colin Powell has been unanimously approved by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The panel approved him without dissent yesterday, just one day after his testimony. For Energy Secretary designate Spencer Abraham, it was even quicker. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee recommended his confirmation hours after his confirmation hearing started. It's taking a little longer for others. Interior Secretary designate and lead pro-lead paint lobbyist Gail Norton faces another day of questioning today. Colin Powell is expected to be confirmed by the full Senate tomorrow, just hours after President-elect Bush is sworn into office. A federal judge is expected to rule on demonstrators' claims that their free speech rights at tomorrow's inaugural events are being stifled by stiff security rules intended to weed out protesters. People attending tomorrow's events will face searches and checkpoints, as well as a heavy police presence. Yesterday, three people were arrested after scaling the Department of the Interior building and unfurling an anti-Bush banner. A day before leaving office, President Clinton will be issuing a final round of pardons today. White House officials won't say who's on the list, but those who've sought Clinton's mercy include junk bond king Michael Milken, Whitewater defendant Susan McDougal, former Clinton law partner Webster Hubbell, and Leonard Peltier, the Native American leader who has been at Leavenworth, now imprisoned for a quarter of a century. The president stresses most of the people he will pardon will be unknown and all will long since have paid their debt to society. The president says his main goal is to lift restrictions on voting and employment. A town is being sued for allegedly allowing several rogue police officers to menace, intimidate, and sexually harass citizens, including 16-year-old girls. New York State filed a civil rights lawsuit yesterday seeking a federal monitor to watch over Orange County's Wallkill Department while police officers trained and the department is professionalized. This according to New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Spitzer called the force a collection of, quote, untrained and unsupervised men and women armed with guns and the authority of police officers. The lawsuit alleged the town's political leaders ignored requests by citizens to stop the problem perpetuated over a period of at least 2 years by about six members of the department's 25 officers. The New York State Attorney General claims some officers used an unmarked car they called the stealth car to stop women for traffic violations in order to solicit dates, sexual favors, or simply for sport. Philippine President Joseph Estrada's government collapsed today, but he says he will only hand over power after a snap election in May. The proposal was immediately rejected by the vice president, Estrada's constitutional successor, and his bitter political rival. Most of the cabinet, the entire armed forces leadership, and the whole national police withdrew support during the tension-filled day, saying they would not hold office under Estrada's leadership following his impeachment trial on charges of corruption. Many of them in and other senior military officers then joined some 200,000 people holding a rally at the site of the 1986 People Power Revolution that toppled dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Congolese dissidents urged Joseph Kabila to take advantage of his father's death and join efforts to end the 2.5-year civil war that has split their nation in two. The Congolese Rally for Democracy and their key ally Rwanda said they would take no military action until Joseph Kabila makes his next move. Laurent Kabila, the Congolese president, has been confirmed dead. With California residents staring at another possible day of rolling blackouts, state lawmakers have approved a plan aimed at easing the state's power crisis. The stopgap $400 million plan would let California buy power on the open market and sell it to cash-strapped utilities at little cost. Governor Gray Davis is expected to sign the measure today.
This is what George Bush will be saying to the American public on January 20th, 2001. My fellow Armenians, as I stand here today looking over this magnificent Viagra, I think we can agree that the past is over. Our country is ready for a fresh, bipolar approach. I want to bring our country together. I want to do to this country what I did to Texas. I was raised in the west of Texas. It's pretty close to California, in more ways than Washington, D.C. is close to California. We are on the hill, shining on the city, and each of us can get to the top if we set our feet to it. Americans have made their decision. They don't need sympathy. They need condolences. Condolences and credit cards. We need to move beyond the petty armadillos. Politics doesn't have to be the way it is today. We can make the pie higher. A high pie lets everyone put food on their family and their family on the table.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As hearings on the confirmation of John Ashcroft continue in the Senate, there is no sign of a break in GOP support for President-elect Bush's choice for Attorney General. Despite Senator Edward Kennedy raising the possibility of a filibuster, Democratic leaders signal they will not try to defeat the nomination. 17 witnesses spoke yesterday about Ashcroft's character and his record on issues involving women's rights, civil rights, law enforcement, and crime victims. But it was Judge Ronnie White, the first African member of the Missouri Supreme Court, who delivered the key testimony against Ashcroft. White said that Ashcroft, quote, seriously distorted the juris record to block his federal judgeship for what Senate Democrats said were political reasons. This is an excerpt of Ronnie White's testimony.
And then I learned that Senator Ashcroft was opposing me. I was very surprised to hear that he had gone to the Senate floor and called me pro-criminal with a tremendous bent toward criminal activity, that he told his colleagues that I was against prosecutors and the culture in terms of maintaining order. I deeply resent those baseless misrepresentations. In fact, and I want to say this as clearly as I can, my record belies those accusations. Senator Ashcroft said on the Senate floor that I had a serious bias against the death penalty. According to my records, at the time of my hearing, I had voted to affirm the death penalty in 41 of 59 cases that I had heard. In 10 of the remaining 18 cases, I joined a unanimous court in voting to reverse. In two other reversals, I voted with the court majority. These are the facts. I voted with the majority of the court in 53 of 59 death penalty cases. In only 6 cases did I dissent, and only 3 of those was I the lone dissenter. Senator John Ashcroft has pointed to the case of State versus Johnson as the main reason he opposed my nomination. Yet this case did not appear in any of the questions he sent to me. Senator Ashcroft never raised the Johnson case with me, never questioned me about my opinion or asked me to explain my reasoning. My dissenting opinion in this case urged a new trial, not a complete release. I based my opinion on the sound and settled constitutional law as handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court in Strickland versus Washington. I never disregarded the terrible violence that had been done in this case. Senator Ashcroft's rhetoric left the impression that I was calling for Johnson's release. This is just not true. The record of this case, indeed my entire record, shows that it's not true. A record I am now glad to have the opportunity to explain to the United States Senate. My record as a judge shows that the personal attacks made on me were not true. I am proud of my record as a judge. I have lived up to the confidence expressed in me by Governor Carnahan and the people of Missouri. After decades of public service, I come before you today more committed than ever to the rule of law. When I was 10 years old, I stood up to the bullies who made mean-spirited comments and tried to drive me away. Today, I am here to stand up for my record, my reputation as a judge, and as a citizen. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today, and I will be pleased to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Judge.
That was Judge Ronnie White, the first African-American member of the Missouri Supreme Court, delivering his testimony against John Ashcroft as Attorney General. Ashcroft, who was seeking re-election to the Missouri Senate, persuaded Republican colleagues to vote down White in the first full Senate defeat of a district court nominee in 40 years. Ashcroft, who used a strong death penalty stance as a campaign issue, called White pro-criminal and accurately charged that White opposed capital punishment. Meanwhile, one day after Ashcroft promised not to seek Supreme Court reversal of a woman's right to abortion, President-elect Bush told Fox News that he would not rule out joining a case that seeks to overturn abortion rights. Bush said, "Not at all. We just have to see what the case is. As you know, I campaigned as a pro-life candidate." We go back now to the Ashcroft confirmation hearing, where Judge Ronnie White was questioned by Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy.
I think the last time I saw you was at your other appearance before the committee, your confirmation hearing back in May of 1998. Now, as you noted in your testimony today, Senator Ashcroft said that he based his opposition to you on three of your decisions from the hundreds of cases you've heard. He told the Senate that you are pro-criminal, with a tremendous bent toward criminal activity, anti-death penalty, and against prosecutors and the culture in terms of maintaining order. Inflammatory charges, and they're charges that have always troubled me. And I was concerned in the 2 days and hours of hearings that Senator Ashcroft never disavowed that language. He had a lot of opportunities to do so in answers to questions by Senator Durbin and a number of others here. In fact, I went back and reread the three cases in which he convinced his colleagues, his Republican colleagues, to vote against you on October 5th. That was a time when they all came out of the Republican caucus and in a party line vote, something I'd never seen before, in a case like this, voted to not allow you to go on the federal bench. And I hope all senators will read those cases themselves or consider the two columns written by the noted conservative columnist Stuart Taylor in National Journal over the last 2 years on these decisions, and I will be inserting those and some other items in the record. So I've thought about this. It has troubled me for really more than a year. I still don't understand what motivated Senator Ashcroft to fight so hard to have your nomination defeated. I've gone over and over the record. I've talked to him about it. I have found something interesting. Senator Ashcroft inserted a short statement in our committee records in May 1998 in which he noted a different reason to oppose your confirmation. He wrote, quote, "I've been contacted by a constituent or injured by the nominee's manipulation of legislative procedures while a member of the Missouri General Assembly. This contributes to my decision to vote against the nomination." I wasn't sure what he was talking about, so I went back to some of the questions that he had submitted to you, written questions. He asked about a vote you had, question. And so I'd ask you about that. That vote that he asked you about was a vote on restrictive anti-abortion legislation that then-Governor Ashcroft was supporting. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And do you recall what happened in that incident?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I was asked this question by Senator Ashcroft regarding that, and here was the answer I gave. The question was, I understand that while you served in the state legislature, you called an unscheduled vote that resulted in the defeat of a measure designed to limit abortions. Could you please provide the details of this incident? Here was my answer. As chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, I promised the sponsor of the legislation that I would give him a hearing date that was convenient for a majority of the committee members. On the evening in question, the bill's sponsor repeatedly demanded that we take up his bill. I objected and stated we would hear the bill at a later time, after I'd had an opportunity to notify all the committee members. The bill's sponsor continued to disrupt the committee by speaking loudly without being recognized by the chair. This conduct persisted for at least 15 minutes. Finally, I recognized a committee member who made a motion to bring up the bill. This motion was seconded, and a vote was taken, which defeated the measure by a tie vote. This drastic action only occurred as a result of the unruly behavior of the bill sponsor. There was no attempt to deceive the committee members not present by taking a vote behind their backs.
Now, this was so the sponsor of the bill, which then Governor Ashcroft supported, as I understand.
I believe that's correct.
He insisted you bring it up. When you brought it up, he lost on a tie vote. Do you think this is something that happened years and years ago in a legislative body where people for and against an issue voted on it? Do you feel this contributed to Senator Ashcroft's efforts, as it turned out, successful efforts to derail your nomination to the federal bench?
Senator, I don't know exactly what Senator Ashcroft's concerns were, but it caused me a concern when I received the additional questions and he specifically asked about that legislation in 1992. And what I've said to you this morning are the facts surrounding that.
Judge White, you serve on the committee, on the bench, with a number of justices who were appointed by then Governor Ashcroft. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You have had a number of death penalty cases that have come before the court. Do you know how often you voted the same way, either to uphold or to remand death penalty cases? How many times you voted in conjunction with those appointed by then Governor Ashcroft?
I don't have the specific numbers, Mr. Chairman, but I believe that it's about 75% of the time.
Yeah.
As the numbers indicate, there are 41 of 56 or 58 cases where I voted to affirm the death penalty.
Would it surprise you if I told you that a survey done independently finds that you voted with the Ashcroft appointees 95% of the time?
Well, not really, because there is not that much variation on those death penalty cases.
So if you're so completely out of step, they got to be a bit out of step, too. I mean, that's my point. The fact is, on the case that we keep hearing about, this gruesome murder case, is not a fact that you were not trying to release the person charged with murder. You were just trying to make sure he got a fair trial. Is that correct?
That's correct. What I was trying to do was to make sure that the defendant had competent counsel before there was any talk of punishment. And in that case, I urged a new trial so that he could get competent counsel.
And in your experience, is there any question that in a case like that, if he was found guilty, a jury would in all likelihood recommend the death penalty, and that death penalty would be upheld?
I believe so.
Thank you.
Senator Leahy questioning African-American Judge Ronnie White. Ashcroft successfully blocked the federal judgeship that Ronnie White had so wanted. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, that testimony from the Ashcroft confirmation hearings yesterday by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Ashcroft continues in the confirmation hearings today. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, we go to Washington to find out about the protests that are planned for the inauguration of George W. Bush. We'll also get the latest on the Leonard Peltier case, the last day for President Clinton to consider executive clemency for the Native American leader. And then we'll look at the cornerstone of the Clinton administration, the Clinton years, the selling of free trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the subversion of American democracy. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of people are expected to descend on Washington for tomorrow's inauguration of George W. Bush. But protesters planning to voice their opposition to the incoming administration should find out this morning how far they're allowed to go. A federal judge is expected to rule on the demonstrators' claims that their free speech rights at tomorrow's inaugural events are being stifled by stiff security rules intended to weed out protesters. People attending tomorrow's events will face searches and checkpoints, as well as a heavy police presence. Yesterday, three people were arrested after scaling the Department of the Interior building and unfurling an anti-Bush banner. We're joined right now by Nadine Block, who is one of those who's organizing the protest tomorrow. Also, Teresa Gutierrez is with us from the International Action Center, an organizer and activist. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Nadine Block, what is the judge deciding today?
Well, he's deciding a couple of things. Of cases that have been brought up, points that have been brought up. One is there's a challenge to checkpoints and the possibility for discriminating choices about what and who you let through checkpoints. There's a D.C. law that talks about speaking on, and if you're allowed to speak as a part of a rally or separate from a rally, and a few other issues that that could be construed as discriminatory or different pieces for different political folks, in other words.
Teresa Gutierrez, what are the streets like?
Well, there's quite a buzz in New York, and we're very lucky that the judge that was assigned to our case, Gladys Kessler, is from what we gather, her reputation is that she's very fair and progressive. And I think just that I was one of those that was in the hearing courtroom yesterday, and I want to share the feeling and the tone and of the hearing. I think that overall the press and the supporters that were in the courtroom yesterday could see that the government side was on the defensive, that they weren't prepared, that they couldn't defend their case, that, you know, that they had not applied for Freedom Plaza. And it became quite clear that if anyone who was objective could see that we're going to be victorious today, and we're very confident that everything that we're asking for, unobstructed access to Freedom Plaza tomorrow, will happen, and we expect to hear at 10 a.m. this morning, in just a little while, that the movement that started in Seattle and is continuing is going to be victorious tomorrow. And the kind of press that we have received across the United States and across the world is very important, that we're able to get Voting While Black and the death penalty and Vieques and Cuba and Mumia and all the other important issues on the national and international agenda. And so the lawsuit has provided that opportunity for us. And so while Bush may think that tomorrow may usher in a reactionary, pro-rich climate, we think just the opposite is happening.
There are a number of protests that are taking place tomorrow, among them the National Action Network, Al Sharpton, Ron Daniels of the Center for Constitutional Rights will be protesting and marching to the Supreme Court, where Arthur Kanoy will be presiding over a shadow inauguration. The International Action Center is going to be at 14th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. There's going to be votermarch.org. They're assembling at the Ellipse. I know their website, votermarch.org. Justice Action Movement assembling in affinity groups of 25 or less. The National Organization for Women is going to be at Navy Memorial with signs and banners defending abortion rights. So there's going to be a lot of activity tomorrow. And one way that activity is being covered is by a new independent media movement that has grown up particularly in the last year around this country and around the world, the IMCs, the Independent Media Centers, providing voice to progressive activism. A Washington, D.C.-based IMC is going to be providing up-to-date information and live coverage. It's already going on right now on the internet of inaugural and counter-inaugural events at www.indymedia.org. And we're joined right now by Eddie Becker, who is an independent filmmaker who is part of the team that is streaming the audio that is taking place 24 hours a day. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Eddie Becker.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
Can you explain what it is that you're doing?
Well, I think it's a first. We're doing this constant internet stream audio at dc.indymedia.org. And for actually a very modest amount, we're on now 24 hours streaming all over the world. And what we're going to try to do is a simulcast, so people who are not going to be able to make it to any of the demonstrations can watch the coronation on television, and hopefully they'll turn down their audio and turn up this alternative sound. And we're going to have reports from the street. We're going to have various experts talking about where democracy is going and what this government that's coming in, what the impact it's going to have on us all.
Did you cover the scaling of the Department of Interior building?
Well, if you look at our page, there's some like remarkable things. We actually have very few, you know, direct reporters. It's anybody who becomes a reporter. That's what's so unique about the Indy Media site. Anyone can self-publish, and anybody can comment on what's published. So, yes, there's I woke up one morning, and I saw this huge spread. It's now on our front page. It shows the scaling story with a wonderful graphic.
Can you read a little to us to find out who it was that scaled the wall and what was the banner that they unfurled?
When you say, can I read a little, anybody can read it. They just need to go to the dc.indymedia.org.
Right. I was just wondering if by chance you had it in front of you.
I'm not in front of my computer at the moment.
Well, let me ask Teresa Gutierrez or Nadine Block if you can explain what that first action was about.
I've been totally out of what's happening in terms of that. We've been consumed with this lawsuit and media work. So I'm sorry, I can't speak to that.
Teresa?
I actually don't know. We've been consumed with the lawsuit. And
well, we'll let people know right. on Monday.
Okay, this is Nadine, and I actually do know.
Okay,
it's,
Nadine.
It was three Greenpeace activists who scaled the Department of Interior building to protest Norton's nomination and to talk about preserving our wild areas in this country.
And, of course, Gail Norton, the designee for Secretary of the Interior, was Colorado Attorney General and in the last years the lead lobbyist for the pro-lead paint lobby for NLI, National Lead Industries. Her confirmation hearings continue today. Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We'll certainly be covering what happens in the sounds of the streets tomorrow, bringing that to our listeners on Monday on Democracy Now! Nadine Block, Teresa Gutierrez, and Eddie Becker of the IMC, Eddie Becker of the Independent Media Center, which is streaming 24 hours a day on the web, the inauguration and counter-inauguration activities. We're going to move now very quickly to Lawrence, Kansas, where Jennifer Harbury is standing by on this last day of the Clinton administration. He is weighing whether to grant a number of pardons and executive clemencies. The White House officials say they won't say who's on the list, but those who've sought Clinton's mercy include junk bond king Michael Milken, Whitewater defendant Susan McDougal, former Clinton law partner Webster Hubbell, and Leonard Peltier, Native American leader at Leavenworth, now in prison for a quarter of a century. Jennifer Harbury is his attorney. Jennifer, what is the latest news you have from the White House?
Well, there really is no news at this time, Amy. We're down to just waiting, you know, waiting with a lot of hope. And people around the world are calling to tell us that they're praying for Leonard. And a number of wonderful letters have come in from different human rights activists and religious leaders from around the world and within the United States as well. And I think that's the one thing that's happened, the one achievement that has already taken place that really gives me a real sense of not only pride but hope for the future. We have letters from people of different races and religions, you know, within the walks of human rights from so many different places. And it really shows a racial unity and a trend towards unification of different human rights causes. It's very unusual. And we have Nobel laureate Rigoberta Menchu for indigenous rights, and of course Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa, and Nobel laureate Jose Ramos Horta from East Timor, and all of them have gotten together. We have the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Coretta Scott King and National Council of Churches and kind words from the Mary Knowles. And it's wonderful to see all of these people with all of their different beliefs and cultures and races blending together and unifying behind this. Mm-hmm. So we've all been very, very happy to see this. With regard to President Clinton's decision, we're just waiting, and we have the prayers of many, many people, Native American and all different churches.
What would executive clemency mean for Leonard Peltier right now? Does it mean he would be released from Leavenworth immediately?
It most likely would. There sometimes are conditions placed, as we remember last year, of course. But most likely he would simply be flat-out released, yes.
And President Clinton has until, what, the time of the inauguration to issue?
Yes, he could sign on to clemency an hour before the inauguration ceremony if he chose to do so.
And have you had any contact with the White House recently? Is there any indication which way they will go?
There is no indication at this time how they'll go on any of those clemencies. They've preferred to, you know, remain private in those considerations, and we've tried to respect that.
Well, I know that the White House comment line has been shut down in this transition period, but I understand that there is still a fax number that's up. People can go to the Free Peltier website at freepeltier.org, but there is a phone number in Washington. Maybe it's the lone fax that hasn't been taken out by the movers yet at the White House. And that number is 202-456-2461. That's 202-456-2461. In this last day, however you feel about the case of Leonard Peltier, to let the president know what you think he should do, whether he should be granted executive clemency or not. Your most powerful argument when you're asked in the media. I don't know how often you're asked by the corporate media to talk about the Peltier case for why you think he should be free at this point. Jennifer Harbury.
I think the most important reason right now is what President Clinton has been saying throughout the week, that there's a great need for racial unity, the rectification of historic wrongs and injustices, and for national reconciliation between all of the races in this country. You know, if our country, with all of the different ethnic, racial, and cultural and linguistic groups that exist within our national borders, is going to evolve and remain a great power, then we have to learn to coexist and respect one another and see our differences as enrichment and not threats to each other's welfare. And I just think this will be a very major and very historical step forward on the front of national reconciliation.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Leonard Peltier, in prison for a quarter of a century, he was convicted of first-degree murder in the killing of two FBI agents in 1975. He says he did not execute these FBI agents. The killings took place on the Pine Ridge Reservation in the midst of a shootout between the FBI agents and members of the American Indian Movement. I want to thank you for being with us, Jennifer Harbury.
And we want to thank you, Amy, for your amazing coverage of so many different issues. You really are a source of information that we're unable to get from most other news channels. So thank you again.
Thank you. And we'll keep close watch on what happens over these next 24 hours and certainly report to our listeners on Monday. Jennifer Harbury, the attorney for Leonard Peltier, also well known for her work in Guatemala, her husband killed by the CIA-backed military in Guatemala. She has cases against the U.S. government in Everardo's case, her husband, who died years ago. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to our last segment, President Clinton bid farewell to the nation in a 7-minute address last night. He said goodbye and claimed he'd presided over an era of great American renewal that leaves the nation far better equipped to meet the future than when he arrived.
I have steered my course by our enduring values. Opportunity for all, responsibility from all, a community of all Americans. I have sought to give America a new kind of government, smaller, more modern, more effective, full of ideas and policies appropriate to this new time, always putting people first, always focusing on the future.
President Clinton speaking last night in his final address to the nation. Well, a key part of his legacy, a cornerstone of his administration, has been the passage of NAFTA. In the early days of the Clinton presidency, he pushed the free trade treaty. And now that he's leaving, President-elect Bush has indicated he will expand NAFTA to South America. But serious doubts exist about whether NAFTA has fulfilled all the promises Clinton made, whether, for example, increased jobs on both sides of the border, as well as many other issues. Today, we're going to take a close look at how NAFTA passed and what this legacy is all about. We're joined right now by John MacArthur, the author of The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. He's also the publisher of Harper's Magazine. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
So, in this 8 years, President Clinton is perhaps most proud of his promulgation of free trade. You follow this closely from the beginning.
Yes, and the amazing thing about free trade is that it has been transformed into a what is perceived by liberals, particularly as a kind of social welfare program for the third world. And what it really is a, and I'm not exaggerating when I use this expression, it's a form of labor racketeering that would be illegal in the United States if it was practiced here. What NAFTA did initially was to reassure investors. The point of, it was an investment agreement, no question, intended to prop up the oligarchy at that time led by Carlos Salinas, the president of Mexico. But it quickly became clear to the Fortune 500, which worked very hard with Clinton to pass NAFTA, although he had to convince them of this, that it was also a terrific way to guarantee cheap labor in Mexico, because the key provisions in NAFTA are the expropriation clauses, which make it very, very costly for a government or for anyone in Mexico to seize American assets. Historically, American companies have been afraid to invest in Mexico to some extent because of the 1938 nationalization of the oil business, where they seized American oil assets. And nobody was about to go into Mexico without some guarantees that if there was political instability or a more left-wing government got control, as happened in the 30s, that they would their assets would be protected. But then it becomes clear that the real asset in Mexico is not the factory itself, because nowadays all you need is a source of electricity, relatively cheap electricity. You can set up a factory anywhere in the world very, very quickly. What's terrific about Mexico from the corporation's point of view is that it's close to the American market and the labor is cheap. So what NAFTA does is essentially ensure that wages cannot rise in Mexico. And I say this to people, and they just can't believe me. They keep saying, NAFTA was all intended to help the Mexicans and increase exports to Mexico and also raise their wages and their standard of living. Well, if anybody who goes down to the border there and interviews the people who manage the maquiladoras, as I did, you find out very quickly, first of all, the maquiladora managers, they all talk to each other, make sure that wages don't go above $1 an hour and that everybody works a 48-hour week at minimum. And then, of course, there's the CTM, the Mexican Union, which enforces compliance with this. If an independent union tries to form within a factory or outside of a factory, they work with the government to crack down and make sure the union doesn't form. And, of course, if you try to take your labor elsewhere, that is to the United States, which is what a lot of intelligent desperate Mexicans do, there are 10,000 Border Patrolmen waiting there to send you back into the labor market. And that is the key provision. That's the key in understanding labor racketeering, that is, which is the fixing of the price of labor illegally. You have to understand this sort of triangle of the border guards, the American factory managers, and the Mexican government with its house union preventing anybody from bargaining for higher wages.
We're talking to John MacArthur. He's author of The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton gave his final speech last night, 7 minutes before the nation. He gave it during prime time. He told Americans goodbye. He said one of his proudest accomplishments was being able to pay down the national debt. And he said he was profoundly grateful for the chance to serve full terms. He's the first Democrat to do that since Franklin Roosevelt. Even as the president was working on a speech, his staffers were clearing out the Oval Office. President Clinton is expected to fly to New York tomorrow as George W. Bush becomes the next president of the United States. But perhaps the issue that made progressives in this country the most cynical about the Clinton-Gore administration was the pushing through of NAFTA and the failure of a overhaul of the healthcare system in this country. Our guest is John MacArthur. The Selling of Free Trade is his book, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. He's the publisher of Harper's. You know, there's an interesting piece in the New York Times today, a photograph on the front page of the business section. It says, cell phones for the world's poor. So we won't give them food. We'll give them cancer. But
or they can call, or they can call out for food, phone for takeout or something.
But let's go back in time, because this passage of NAFTA, the really tremendous battle that took place in Congress exposed how power works, whether it's Republican or Democrat, what President Clinton did.
Right. Just to take you back to those great days of the early months of the Clinton administration, he has to make a decision what to push first on his legislative agenda. Hillary Clinton wants to push health care, and other people want to push NAFTA to prove that Clinton is a new Democrat, and that is a Democrat capable of raising big money from the corporations, from private enterprise, and that he's a right-wing Democrat and not a left-wing Democrat or a liberal Democrat. So Clinton forms an alliance. He decides, first of all, he's going to do NAFTA first. I joke now that the real betrayal of Hillary Clinton is for free trade, not free love. The decision Clinton makes is very cynical. He says, this is something I can win, and also it's a way to ingratiate myself with the big money. And I'm not making this up. Anybody who knows politics in Washington, this is not a theory, will tell you this. David Bonnier, the deputy, the number two Democrat in the House, says this to me in the book. I mean, he has no illusions about what Clinton's ambition is here. He doesn't believe in free trade per se. Which, by the way, this is not. It's not in classical economic terms free trade. He understands it's a power move. So Clinton hires, in effect, the Business Roundtable, or they hire him. It's hard to say which comes first. I think Clinton is the great initiator of this, to put together something called USA NAFTA and lobby this thing through. Now, there are two major parts to this propaganda campaign, which is amazingly sophisticated. One is just raw advertising and misleading public relations. To get that going, the White House shares its polling data with the Business Roundtable, which has to be the front organization for this, and they conclude that the best spokesman, the best salesman in America, maybe after Clinton, is Lee Iacocca. Clinton personally recruits Iacocca to be the spokesman for the pro-NAFTA campaign. In effect, the spokesman for the White House, as well as for the Business Roundtable. He calls him at his home in Tuscany in the middle of the night and begins a long courtship where Iacocca finally agrees to do just that and be the spokesman. Clinton also helps the Business Roundtable raise money for this because Iacocca wants to know, where's the money going to come for the advertising? I never get involved in anything unless I know there's a big budget. And so Clinton is very much in contact with all the people around Iacocca who have to convince the Business Roundtable that Clinton is serious about NAFTA, because the Republican businessmen think, we don't know Clinton from a hole in the wall. He's in the hole in the ground. He's a Democrat. He sometimes sounds like a liberal. He says he's friendly with the labor unions. We don't trust him. Prove that you're serious, Clinton, and Clinton proves it. By recruiting Iacocca, by putting a NAFTA trade fair on the White House lawn, which you may recall, an incredible shenanigan, which I just can't believe they turn over public property for a purely private initiative, where you bring every corporation had a little pavilion, like a little World's Fair for the Fortune 500, with a Caterpillar tractor here God knows what, an AIG insurance policy there or whatever. And all of this is designed for the cameras. It's for public relations. They're very sophisticated about this. They save the outtakes. to make TV commercials and to send to television stations so that the local television stations, you know this goes on, Amy, can pretend that they've got someone on the scene reporting from Washington when, in fact, it's a White House tape. They hire, Business Roundtable hires so-called grassroots organizations to whip up enthusiasm for NAFTA, which is absolutely preposterous. A majority of people oppose NAFTA and oppose it today. But in order to make it look as though it was a popular issue, that is, shipping jobs to Mexico and exploiting Mexicans, they had to prove to Americans that this is going to be good for them. So they hire these groups that actually generate phone calls to congressmen, like Rick Lazio. There's a funny story in the book where Rick Lazio says
the congressman from New York who ran against Hillary Clinton for Senate.
Calls up the White House and says, I want to work with you. I want to vote for NAFTA, but organized labor is beating me up in my district. Help me. So they get one of these grassroots firms onto the case. They generate hundreds of phone calls and letters to Lazio, which is it's too complicated to explain here how they do it, but they do it. And Lazio calls up after 3 days. He calls up the Business Roundtable lobbyists and says, turn it off. It's enough. I got it. I got what I needed. I got proof that there's popular support for NAFTA. I've got the political cover I need to vote for it.
And then what about the selling of it and the trading of votes? Those Congress members who did not want to vote for NAFTA but were offered.
Right. What finally happens is that even with all this tremendously sophisticated public relations and advertising and Al Gore's terribly mendacious debate against Perot, where he makes up all sorts of facts. I can talk about that later. Clinton still has to buy certain votes. One way he buys them is with straight pork. He gets Mickey Cantor to write a letter to the Florida delegation, which is crucial in this, and says the school lunch program, as of today, is going to buy twice as many tomatoes as it used to. That's one way you buy votes, because they're very worried about Mexican tomato imports. The other way to do it is funnier, but equally effective and equally corrupt. And I tell this story in the book. There's a congressman from a right-wing Democrat from Oklahoma named Bill Brewster, who says to Clinton, he's a holdout, and he's hearing these stories that you can get almost anything from Clinton if you wait long enough. He'll promise you a bridge or God knows. Well, he doesn't need a bridge in Oklahoma, but he does need something. He's on the board of the National Rifle Association. So Clinton calls him up on his cell phone. Actually, Brewster pulls over to the side of the road in the middle of his district, and Clinton says, what's it going to take? And Brewster says, well, I'd like a duck hunting date with you, Mr. President. Clinton says, no problem. Clinton, of course, knows the significance of that. And Brewster votes for NAFTA. And 2 months after NAFTA passes, they go duck hunting in Maryland. It's a wonderful photo opportunity. And Brewster gets his a shot of himself with the President of the United States with a rifle, which is what he needs as a board member of the NRA. So he sells out the gun control lobby to some extent to get the vote he needs to pass NAFTA. It's an abysmal, just a dreadful story of cynical politics. But it's pure Clinton, and of course Hillary Clinton knows. And I'm not any great partisan of Hillary Clinton, but she knows as a practical matter, if you push NAFTA and you exhaust and alienate your liberal and union allies, it's going to be a lot harder to pass health care. They're going to be tapped out, and that's exactly what happened. They were tapped out. And when I hear people say that the 94 victory for the Republicans, the supposed Gingrich revolution, indicated a new sort of conservatism in the country, a hostility to activism, to government activism, it was a repudiation of Clinton's liberal activism, I see exactly the opposite argument, which is that liberals and union members who are key to winning elections for Democrats stayed home and said, not only did he sell us out on NAFTA, he didn't fight hard for health care. What's the point? Why should we get out and vote work for this guy? And there is some anecdotal evidence to support my thesis. Sherrod Brown, a Democratic congressman from Ohio, told me that the only way he survived in 94, he voted against NAFTA, was to go around courting every single Perot voter from 92 to say to them, please don't get me mixed up with the Democratic Party or the White House on this issue. I was against NAFTA. I fought it tooth and nail. Don't blame me. And he barely survived. Whereas a lot of Democrats who voted for it or didn't vote for it got blamed.
When you say that that they tapped out the union support, liberal support when it came to health care, I mean, Hillary Rodham Clinton herself did not tap the liberal support base she would have needed to overhaul health care. I mean, you had the what was it called? The Jackson Hole Group, who were the group of businessmen, insurance industry people. These were her advisors. She had no consumer activists part of that group.
Right. As I say, I'm not a great admirer of hers, but she did complain vociferously in the fall of 93 and say, you are putting NAFTA ahead of health care. We're going to lose health care because of all the emphasis and all the horse trading, using up all your political capital, whatever it is, on NAFTA, and we're gonna lose.
We're talking to John MacArthur. He's publisher of Harper's The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA Washington and the Subversion of American Democracy is his book. As we move now into the inauguration of George W. Bush, do you see he will be any different when it comes to this? I mean, people say, oh, this is going to be much worse, but is it?
No, it's exactly the same. And again, we're into one of these crazy straw man arguments where the Republicans are going to say, we'll only accept, we'll only negotiate free trade deals as long as there are no health or labor safeguards written into them. And that will become the great contentious issue. And if they do pass another free trade bill, you can see them putting in health and environmental safeguards. Of course, anybody who knows anything about this issue knows that the Democrats, in order to placate the left wing of the party, put in absolutely toothless labor and environmental safeguards in the NAFTA agreement. It's preposterous. Even Gephardt, who is very wishy-washy on this issue, calls the labor and environmental side agreements in NAFTA a hoax. They are a hoax. Nobody has won an environmental case or an unfair labor practice case to date through the NAFTA tribunals. You can't. You can't. Even if you did, the Mexican government, the old Mexican government, wouldn't respect them. The American government, I don't know what we would say if we lost. Most of these are directed at the Mexicans, of course. Things may change because Fox is in power, and the principal NAFTA critics on the left in Mexico is now part of his sort of coalition government. Jorge Castañeda is the new foreign minister. I know Jorge very well. I mean, he was an NYU professor not so long ago, and we were chatting about all these things, and I'm absolutely astonished that he's in a position of power now. But I don't know how he gets Fox to change NAFTA or demand a better deal for Mexican workers when they are so dependent on NAFTA. There are more than a million maquiladora workers along the border now who, if you abrogated NAFTA or reformed it, quote-unquote, would lose their jobs or could lose their jobs because the American companies would up and move to Guatemala.
So in this last 15 seconds, John MacArthur, do you see tomorrow, the inauguration of George W. Bush, as any kind of real changing of the guard?
No, it's back to the future. It's his father's plan. Remember, Clinton adopts a plan invented. The NAFTA plan is invented by George Bush Sr. Clinton adopts it and rams it through. If anything, it's going to be more of the same.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA Washington and the Subversion of American Democracy is his book. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. You can write to us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Fired and The Banned, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!